This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasoline. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstand Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
11:05 here on the wake-up call. A very interesting program for the rest of the hour. At least that's what I'm counting on. Professor, are you counting on that as well?
That's my plan.
All right. University English professor Paul Cantor in the studio today. And we're going to talk a little bit about television. We're going to talk a little bit about politics. We're going to talk a little bit about globalization. All that fun stuff. Pop culture. And how you can put it all in one book. Professor Cantor's book, Gilligan Unbound, Pop Culture in the Age of Globalization. Now, I think it was promoted here on over the station as being new, but it's actually 3 or 4 years old, isn't it?
Right. It came out in 2001.
Although you did just this week receive a little Daily Progress local news bit, correct?
Yes. Well, I was updating the book at a talk on Tuesday night for the Students for Individual Liberty at UVA.
I guess one of the first questions that I have, and I'm sure, and you've been on a lot of radio shows, correct, and done a lot of lectures and speeches on similar topics, and we'll get to your background in just a moment. But your specialty is Shakespeare.
That's right.
So how does a Shakespearean professor start writing about television in Gilligan's Island?
Very circuitously. That is, I just as a joke started to see if I could take some of the skills I developed as a Shakespeare scholar and apply them to contemporary pop culture. And I was surprised at the results. I started giving lectures on Gilligan's Island, on Star Trek, on The Simpsons, and people seemed really interested in them. And I decided maybe there was a kind of secondary career for me here.
Well, I think it's everybody's secret wish is to write the great novel. And in this case, yours isn't particularly a novel, but it's everyone's secret career is to have that sort of ability and get on that path at some point. Give us a little bit of your background so that we can figure out how you ended up coming here and wrote the book.
Well, I didn't come here on the basis of writing a book on television, I can tell you that. My first book was on Shakespeare, and then I wrote a book on romantic poetry. I originally started teaching at Harvard, and when I didn't get tenure there in 1976, UVA made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and that's why I'm here. As I say, I've always wanted to see if I could approach contemporary culture the way I've approached the classics of the past. In a way, it's easy to tell us why Shakespeare's great, and we know he's great already, but I decided I'd look around and see what I could find in my own world and whether I could contribute to understanding that.
Well, give us a little background on the book itself, because I think it seems all too simple to just take the title and say, okay, that's what today's show is about. We're going to talk about TV and pop culture, and I think for a lot of people, including myself, because that's, as I say numerous times, my goal is to always be the dorky listener who needs a lot of things explained. TV and pop culture, great. Globalization, all right, define that a little bit more for me.
Well, it was a bit of a discovery for me myself. That is, I didn't set out to write a book about globalization, but I gradually, as I studied these shows, saw that that was the hidden theme in them. What I do in the book is to take four shows, Gilligan's Island, Star Trek, the original one, The Simpsons, and The X-Files. And I contrast them, the two shows from the 60s against the two shows from the 1990s. What I found when I went back to the 1960s was that the sort of buried theme in a number of the shows was what I call the Americanization of the globe. That is, in Gilligan's Island, you take this representative group of Americans, you drop them anywhere on the planet, some random island, and they take over and they rule. What surprised me was when I realized that was the principle of Star Trek as well. Only in this case, it was the Americanization of the galaxy. One episode after another, Captain Kirk and the Enterprise would come to some planet, and if it didn't look like 1960s America, they remade it until it did. Especially, they wanted every planet to be democratic. And it seemed to me this reflected a kind of political optimism of the 60s, the sort of new frontier spirit of John Kennedy, that America was the greatest country in the world and it could spread its way of life around the globe. A lot of things happened, chiefly the Vietnam War, a lot of other negative things in the 70s and 80s. And by the 90s, I saw a complete reversal in American television, that now the theme was the globalization of America, a sense that America was no longer at the center of the world. The Simpsons treats that rather positively. It gives us a sense that America's globalizing. This little town, Springfield, is open to influences from around the world, and that's presented rather joyously in The Simpsons. But The X-Files was my great example in the book about America's sense of being decentered. You get a feeling in that show that no longer are we in control of our own destiny. There's a kind of international conspiracy that is running the world in conjunction with an alien invasion. And also it seemed to me it reflected a new disillusionment with the American government, the sense that it's invading our privacy, spying on us, not playing fair. And that seemed to be a stark contrast to the way the federal government's presented, particularly back in Star Trek, where it becomes a kind of model for running the whole universe.
I guess one of my early questions, and by the way, Catherine is out there. She moved on from her bluegrass specialty to producing today's show and answering the phone and patching you through. Feel free to dial up 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS on the toll-free line, 1-877-967-6762. As we talk with Professor Cantor, are you saying that TV reflects the era of America, or that America reflects what's being on TV?
In this case, I think it's more that the television reflects America, that these shows...
For all four shows?
Yes, I'll say that in the case of the X-Files, I think it was a bit ahead of its time, and in some ways ended up predicting the era we're in now, where the threat from around the globe is very formless and hard to pin down.
Right, because you mentioned in some of the things that I read about X-Files using the internet and using cell phones, et cetera, before they became such daily parts of our lives.
Yeah, I'd like to think of pop culture sometimes as a kind of distance early warning network. It picks up on trends before the majority of people have.
All right, so again, and I guess I cut you off before you got to finish, TV is reflecting America?
Yeah, basically I think that's true, but again, it's not simply that. Sometimes these shows at least crystallize a mood or crystallize an opinion and therefore give it more force.
All right, so you pick four shows. We've got two from the 60s, Gilligan's Island and Star Trek. You've got two from the 90s, X-Files and Simpsons. By the way, two of my all-time favorite shows there.
Mine too.
Why those four? I mean, I guess you can say that The Simpsons and The X-Files and Star Trek even sort of have their own cult followings. But Gilligan's Island doesn't, it seems to be that old Sesame Street, which one of these things is not like the other?
Well, some people have claimed that Gilligan's Island has been viewed by more people on Earth than any other show in history, with, I guess, I Love Lucy being the alternative. I really began with Gilligan's Island and was just struck by the success of that show. And I couldn't understand it until I decided that, in fact, it has a surprising amount of content, that it does give us a kind of representative sampling of the forces that rule America. You had the scientist, you had the businessman, you had the skipper representing military value and so on. And it turned out that Sherwood Schwartz, the man who created it, actually had in mind creating a microcosm of American society. I think he succeeded, and why secretly it's been popular all these years.
And you think that 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 was intentional or just, you know, the cosmos aligning properly?
I at first thought it was an accident, but I actually got a letter from Sherwood Schwartz telling me that that's what he'd had in mind and that he was so thrilled that someone other than his mother had understood what he was doing. It's one of those great moments in a literary critic's life. Shakespeare, Mr. Big Time Playwright, was too busy ever to send me a letter saying that I got it right. But Sherwood Schwartz came through for me.
Oh, goodness. 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS for your questions or comments on today's program about Gilligan Unbound, pop culture and the age of globalization with University of English professor Paul Cantor. Patriotism, I think I read, was one of the key factors in the 60s shows?
Yes, yes.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, that they reflected a really deep faith in America. And again, the point about Gilligan's Island was you took these representative Americans, and they might squabble amongst themselves, but when faced with any outside threat, they always unite together. And I was very surprised when I went back and reviewed the show to see how much a product of the Cold War it was. The enemies that they encounter on the island, sometimes it was Russian cosmonauts, once it was a Latin American dictator. There really was a 1960s sense in that show of what the place of America in the world was, and it was a very much a kind of Cold War, us versus them mentality. And it was definitely American triumphalism, that these average Americans, and Gilligan was the average American to a T, they could handle any kind of threat just because they were Americans and embodied American values.
I find that to be I can see where the Cold War applies to Star Trek. I was never particularly a Star Trek fan, but certainly I think you'd be hard-pressed because of its pop culture alignment to not see that it's, you know, Americans, science Americans, who actually, I guess, are made up of a large different group as well. I mean, you have an African-American woman. You have a gentleman who's, I don't know, what is Chekhov?
Well, he was added in the second or third season because Pravda, the Soviet Union propaganda newspaper, had run an editorial saying that the show was evil because it claimed to be United Federation of Planets and didn't have a Russian involved. There's a perfect example of how pop culture does reply to political pressures.
All right, we got our first caller for the day. It's Pete from Charlottesville. Hey, Pete.
Hi there.
Oh, fire away. We're seem to both be doing well.
Great. Well, I was listening to Professor Cantor talking about TV shows, and I was wondering if he had ever seen this TV show, The Lone Gunman, that seems to tie in with a lot of these things. I think it's an X-Files spinoff.
Yes. It was the last spinoff of the X-Files, and it's a fascinating illustration of what I'm talking about. The pilot episode of that show, and this is really true, was about a plot by terrorists to fly a plane into the World Trade Center. And that aired in March of 2001. Now, it turned out to be a kind of phony setup, and it wasn't really terrorists. But after the events of 9/11, Washington sent some people out to California to interview people on that show to see how they had come up with this idea. And that's what I mean when I say that the X-Files in general and its various spinoffs was ahead of the curve. It really saw coming things that have now come to dominate events in the beginning of the 21st century.
All right, excellent. 11:19 here on the Wake Up Call. Feel free to dial in with your questions and comments with University of Virginia Professor Paul Cantor as we talk about television and its spin on pop culture. Catherine's here to take your phone calls. File away, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. I will take a moment to tell you the markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley and the Valley. Windy and partly cloudy today. Highs 40 to 45. Clear and windy tonight. Lows 30 to 35. Mostly sunny tomorrow. Highs 45 to 50. It's cloudy all across the listening area. Valley 39, 38 in Lynchburg, 41 in Richmond on the new 103.1. And in Charlottesville, it's 42.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And additional support today also coming from 45fix.com. If you have a project but not the time, there's a simple way to find a contractor. From kitchen and bathroom remodeling, house painting to decks and siding, it's 45fix.com. Immediate, no obligation estimates, available anytime. That's the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And we also want to thank Ted Henneberry, Mike Henrietta, and Gene McCusker for their generous support during the past fall fund drive. It's because of people like them, as well as program underwriters like Starlight Express and Scarpa, that you have the wake-up call here every Sunday. So stay tuned, tell a friend, and get ready to support us during the upcoming spring fund drive. By the way, if you run a business, the wake-up call, always looking for valuable items to reward our donors with. All right. Let's see. We got Ann from here in Charlottesville. Hey, Ann.
Hi. How's it going?
Hey, we're having fun.
Great, great. Well, I have a question for Professor Kanner. I wanted to hear why he thinks The Simpsons reflects a globalized world.
Well, several respects. If you look at the town of Springfield, it's supposedly the average American small town. But it's amazing how permeated it is by foreign influences. There's a section of the town that speaks Russian. There's a section of the town that speaks Spanish. People from all over the world, Paul and Linda McCartney, Elton John, have come there. If you go back to the 1950s and 60s sitcoms, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, it was amazing how insulated an image of the American small town they presented. And Leave It to Beaver, when Wally and the Beav just went to one town over on a bus, it was a major disaster. Whereas the Simpsons have been to Japan, they've been to Brazil, they've been to England, they've been to Australia.
They're not welcome back in Brazil either.
I'm well aware of that. That's the subtitle of my next lecture on this subject down at Emory and Henry later this month. The show really, in a very obvious way, reflects the way the very texture of American life has changed. Lisa is being criticized for being a vegetarian. It turns out there's a Buddhist temple right there in Springfield, and she can go there. Richard Gere happens to be there, and she gets the message that, you know, there are all sorts of vegetarians in the world. Apu, Nasa Pima Petalon, at one point explains, you know, there's 800 million vegetarians in India, and suddenly Lisa doesn't have to feel so bad. In fact, it turns out there's three flights a day from India to Springfield when Apu's bride is sent over from India. So really, when you start looking at the show, it's amazing how globalized an image of America it gives.
Oh, goodness. I could laugh and talk all day about The Simpsons. Feel free, if you'd like to call up and comment on any of the topics presented so far. Pop culture, we are talking about, currently talking about TV, the four particular shows that the professor has chosen: Gilligan's Island, Star Trek, X-Files, and The Simpsons. Dial up 979-0919. If you're down in Richmond on the new 103.1, maybe you're in Lynchburg or Amherst, over in the Valley, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS is the toll-free number. Professor, you talk about how The Simpsons and Springfield show how globalized it is. But what about The Simpsons now going out across the world itself? I read, I don't know, in the last several months about how The Simpsons is now being played in Egypt, but they made major changes to the show itself. Homer doesn't drink beer, Homer doesn't eat pork, etc. What is that doing to the world?
Well, it's a very interesting subject because it's shown in over 100 countries. I've been surprised at how popular it is elsewhere. I can see why in a country like England it would be popular, but it is strange that in countries that have very different cultures, it still seems to go over well. I recently saw it dubbed into German when I was in Europe, and I found it much less funny, but evidently they love it in Germany. But you're absolutely right. They make very interesting changes. I read an article comparing how The Simpsons is dubbed in French-speaking Quebec in Canada as opposed to how it's dubbed in France. And oddly enough, over in Canada, they're are more sensitive about using English terms, so they won't use the term donut. And how can you do The Simpsons without the word donut? But they call them beignets when they translate it for the Quebec show, whereas in Paris, for some reason, they're willing to allow Homer his love for les donuts. Another thing, Apu has a Algerian accent in the French, in the dubbing in France, and he has a Caribbean accent in the dubbing in Quebec. So again, it's endlessly fascinating how the show gets adapted around the world. My essay on The Simpsons was translated into Russian. Much to my surprise, a prominent journal in Russia wanted a copy of it, and so I let them have it.
You know, you mentioned Algeria. One of my all-time favorite Simpsons shows is when they have the Algerian young boy come stay with them.
He's Albanian.
Oh, is he?
Yes, I am. It's actually my favorite episode. That's why I know it.
That's too many beers in the 20s that have killed that brain cell. You know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about from the book as a whole is... I read somewhere, and this might not have been in the book, but it was certainly in my little study about the book and some other interviews with you, etc., where you make a comment that the big three networks seeing their share drop below 50% now that we have all the cable, etc., is quite liberating. But I guess my question to follow that up is, doesn't the lack of consensus make pop culture less frequent? I mean, if we're not all familiar with the same sound, with the same quote, with the same TV show, how does pop culture come about?
Well, I think it is true that we're seeing much more diversification in popular culture in the era of cable. Even I talk a lot in the book about how the Fox network opened things up, broke the sort of monopoly that the big three networks had. And I think it's no accident that both The Simpsons and The X-Files appeared on Fox. And I think it is true that there's less sense of a shared culture. But a shared culture can get very boring and conventional, as I think some of the shows of the 50s and 60s on television show. And I'm more in favor of diversity in popular culture and allowing people to explore different areas. And still, reference points, common reference points do emerge. I think The Simpsons, though it's very much the product of Fox's The Fourth Network and this whole era of sort of denationalization in TV, The Simpsons is sufficiently successful that it certainly has become a reference point in our common culture. So I like to think of it as a kind of Darwinian situation now. We're getting more and more species in this area of popular culture, but still they're in a kind of competition, and certain ones emerge as the new reference points in our culture.
Do you think some of that has to do with the where pop culture doesn't have to come from television, but because The Simpsons did such a wonderful job in marketing that you could go just about anywhere and see a Eat My Shorts t-shirt kind of thing, that helps... it makes things more pronounced.
Yes, and we have the new factor of the internet as a way of disseminating popular culture. The X-Files is an excellent example of that. It wasn't getting dynamite ratings its first season, but what the Fox people were smart enough to see was that it was the first show that really caught on the internet, and they were reading what people were saying about the show on the internet and how passionately committed a certain segment of the audience was, and so they decided to continue with it, and the rest, as we say, is history. But I think the internet is now fulfilling this role of bringing people together in a way that was utterly unanticipated when it first came along.
All right, feel free to dial up 979-0919. Join Pete and Ann with their good questions and comments so far today. 979-0919 for the locals. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS for those who need the toll-free line. I do want to thank Five Guys Burgers and Fries for their support so far today. They are Sevo Reader's choice for burgers and rated by a Zagat Restaurant Survey for 4 years running. Five Guys serves America's standard fresh and handmade from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. and open until 10 Fridays and Saturdays. Five Guys Burgers and Fries behind the fountain in the Barracks Road Shopping Center. Coming soon to the Hollymead Town Center and the Downtown Mall, Charlottesville. 975 Guys. All right, back to Professor Cantor, UVA English professor, as we talk about his book, Gilligan Unbound, Pop Culture in the Age of Globalization. I see Catherine's taking a call, so I'll try and ask a rather short question, or one that we can come back to. Professor, how about a show like The Daily Show with Jon Stewart that seems to be very popular these days? It is another cable show, but you read about how so many young people, that's where they get their news.
Well, I'm not too familiar with the show, but from what I've seen of it, I like it. And it has a very irreverent, cynical attitude, and I find that actually healthy. I think the era when we had the three network anchors and they were treated almost like oracles, that was not, in fact, healthy. I think people need to have an irreverent attitude towards the news today. Therefore, I think things like The Daily Show are very good for America.
I mean, the man has everyone from Hollywood celebrities promoting their movies to political guests from both parties. It just seems an odd and previously unexpected part of pop culture.
Well, what we are seeing is a kind of blurring of the traditional boundaries, particularly between politics and culture in this country. And culture has become very political. Politics has become almost entertainment. There are certain negative aspects to that, certainly. But on the other hand, I almost look forward to the day when politics can be a matter of entertainment. It can be so depressing most of the time.
All right, we have a call from Paul here in Charlottesville. Hey, Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning. Bring it
Thank
on.
You once again for interesting topic. I'd like to add a further comment on Star Trek. The social commentary that Roddenberry was making with the Prime Directive, I think, is an important part of his total vision. And if the professor remembers the first show, I think the pilot, about the people with the big heads who used illusion, I think that was part of Roddenberry telling us the danger of this illusion that is television. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Well, the Prime Directive is very interesting for those of you who don't know. It was this a fundamental rule that the United Federation of Planets should not interfere in any way with the development of a civilization on any planet. The Prime Directive was, in fact, violated in one out of every two episodes, by my count. It's exactly the point I make in my book that supposedly the Enterprise was not going to interfere in these planets, but if they got to a planet and found, for example, that it was a theocracy, that they were worshiping a god, Kirk's first impulse was to destroy that god, set the planet free, and make it democratic. In fact, I think the show very much reflected the tensions of liberal democratic America in the 1960s that then culminated in the Vietnam War, that America was claiming to stand for freedom and democracy, but it was going to use force to impose freedom and democracy on other countries throughout the world. And the later episodes in Star Trek, the third season, really reflect a kind of ambivalence and uncertainty about the Vietnam War. You get several episodes that directly reflect Vietnam War, and Roddenberry, I think, was getting nervous about what the sort of a contradiction of the democratic view that you undemocratically impose democracy on people. The way I like to put it in Star Trek, the Americans would tolerate anything but intolerance, and therefore they would work to kill a Greek god, Apollo, when he was ruling a planet, or there was one planet that followed Plato's Republic. That had to be destroyed. The Prime Directive turns out to be a very contradictory notion in that series.
It sounds like all too many of our current administrators are original fans of the Star Trek organization.
I think that's very true, and it points exactly to the problems of contemporary politics. It's still relevant in that sense.
All right, fire away with the phone, boys and girls, 979-0919-1877-WNRN-ROCKS. Catherine is out there enjoying today's program, but let's give her something to do as well. Professor Paul Cantor here from the University of Virginia English Department. as we talk about his latest, although not particularly new, book, Gilligan Unbound, Pop Culture in the Age of Globalization. Professor, do you have to go to Amazon to find this, or can you get it over at the university bookstore?
I think they have copies there, but they got a very good deal on it on Amazon.com. I have to tell you.
All right. Since the last question, last comment was about Star Trek, let's stick with that for a moment. We were talking about the fact that it definitely reflects the Cold War, sort of the mixed group of Americans versus the evil Klingons. And you make some reference that I picked up somewhere about the Klingons either speaking or referencing Shakespeare.
That's in the Star Trek movie, Star Trek VI. There, the Klingon warlord is constantly quoting Shakespeare. And I found that very interesting because it seemed to reflect a sense that Shakespeare embodies an old sense of aristocracy. I think his name is Commander Chang. He's quoting Henry V, various kings in Shakespeare. And it seemed to be a sense that the only place you could turn for a sense of the old pre-democratic world was to go back to Shakespeare's heroes. And it's Christopher Plummer who plays the part, a very famous Shakespearean actor, and the guy who beat out William Shatner for some prime Shakespeare roles at Stratford, Ontario. So there was something very appropriate there, I'm sure, to Shatner, where he got to shut up this pompous Shakespearean windbag by the end of the film.
And also during the time that it came out, as we talk about the 60s, when certainly the Cold War was a key part of everyday life, of regular fear amongst the more average American. But the scientific aspect seems to have a lot to reflect about the hopes and dreams of what was going on in the 60s.
Yeah, actually, just to go back to Gilligan's Island for a moment, the strangest thing for me in going back to that show was to see that about six of the 90 or so episodes had to deal with intercontinental ballistic missiles, with spaceships and so on, that technological sense of fear and hope was already there in Gilligan's Island. But it certainly was at the center of Star Trek. Star Trek was a kind of big allegory about the Russian-American space race. The big question in episodes was, who's got the better starship? Do the Romulans have a cloaking device that we don't have? And it reflects that tremendous sense of optimism in the 60s that these new technologies were going to open up all sorts of possibilities for people, together with that fear that the new technologies would turn out to be deadly. And so much of the show turned on that fact.
And you know, you mentioned the missiles in Gilligan's Island. There was also the episode